All right, folks, welcome back to the T-Talk podcast brought to you by Flagstick.com. My name is Stefan Tiedorf. I'm back from Mexico, and I'm sitting in the studio with my co-host, Scott McLeod. How are you today?
Hola, hola. How are you?
I don't know if I need to hear that language anymore. Don't offer me a cerveza or anything right now. I need a...
I missed you last week.
Yeah, how was it?
I do things by myself and nobody to talk to. Glad you're back.
Lonely?
There. Yeah, a little bit.
That's all good. Came back just in time. A lot of golf on this weekend and obviously a week away.
I thought you'd dip over to Mexico City for a little...
20 hours from Cancun.
All right, yeah.
You don't think Mexico's that big, but apparently it's very big. But yeah, golf tournament wrapped up in Mexico, obviously, the WGC. The tale of two people that I didn't want to watch and ended up, once I realized it was those two coming down to the end,
you didn't have a choice.
I turned it off. No,
did
I'm not even,
you? Did
I just
you?
Turned it off. I have no interest in watching Patrick Reed or Bryson win at all. Just zero interest. I actually tweeted out if Patrick Reed could. I ended up turning it back on. Somebody texted me, he's going to blow it. And went off his tee shot, right. Which he obviously didn't. But somebody texted me, he's going to blow it. So I turned it back on and I tweeted out, if he could three putt on this 18th hole, I will three putt all year gladly.
I saw that.
That's just how I just can't do Patrick Reed anymore.
You know what? I mean, we'll get into it more. And, obviously there were some great stories last week besides that one. But, you know, this is obviously the elephant in the room. It's been talked about all over the place. Certainly, I don't think you were alone. I think there was a number of people that were probably felt, you know, in the same camp. They're like, Bryson, Patrick, have I had enough of these guys?
Cancel.
Yeah. You know what? Oh, you know, get me some Puerto Rico Open. Let's go watch this instead or whatever. But, obviously Patrick Reed gets his eighth win. Can't deny him that. I think we'll get into that a little bit. You know, great, great putting round for him. Under 100 putts.
Pretty impressive.
Impressive. Obviously, he surged back there and got the win. Bryson had came out really hot and made a lot of birdies early. A lot of people overnight had thought Justin Thomas was going to get the job done, but obviously he did not. I mean,
just on Justin Thomas,
sure.
I did not need to see that kid on TV more
Geronimo.
Than once. Geronimo. I saw him once on Thursday.
Yeah.
Enough. I don't need to see him anymore.
You know, and I think that is the issue. And I mean, I guess we're guilty of it too, because we're talking about Patrick Reed and Bryson. But, you know, the problem with the broadcast sometimes, especially, you know, in a 2-hour case of a broadcast, you know, they beat the same story over and over again. And I get it. Maybe they're trying to get that person that hasn't turned on the broadcast yet and they want to inform them of what's going on. But, you know, once they told the storyline once an hour, it's probably
there's
enough,
Geronimo
right?
watching Justin hit another shot.
Yeah. You know, that's great. You know, they're interacting with people and stuff like that. But there's got to be something else going on that you can talk about. I mean, there's a producer in your ear. There's a chase producer going and trying to get other tidbits, other information. We do it for our own show. We're out trying to find nuggets of information. But, you know, there's got to be another storyline. Just don't beat that one to death.
And I get it. And this is where I'm going to plug another podcast. If you haven't listened to the No Laying Up podcast
with
Peter Costas. He talks about that a lot. Like the cost of a golf tournament nowadays, it's impossible to see all these different shots.
Yeah.
And we're going to get to later on the show, talk about another potential golf tour that is big claims of how they're going to be giving their golf coverage. But stick around for that. But yeah, Peter Costas, you know, basically ripped it apart. I will give them this. I'll give NBC this credit. This week was way better than the previous weeks when we were on CBS, in my opinion. They had a couple where they had screen and screen, a couple different guys out there. They were going back to shots. I appreciated it a lot more than what I was seeing over the last couple weeks. Still wasn't great. It's never going to be great. There is a lot of whys. We don't need to get in the whys. Go listen to Peter Costas.
Yeah.
He'll explain it all.
Yeah, and I guess that's the other side of it. The secret sauce stuff is people don't realize what the limitations are. I mean, golf is the hardest professional sport to broadcast just because, you know, you got golf balls in the air all over the place. You don't have a single ball that you're following like all the other sports. There is some difficulties that way. That said, you know what? They've been broadcasting golf now for almost 70 years. You'd think the formula would start to get a little bit more modern, a little bit change. And now you have the option of having, you know, so much social media feedback. You get to hear what the viewers are interested in, what the readers are in. I mean, we do it for ourselves. I mean, it's trying to hear what people want to talk about, what they want to discuss, what they want to see. So, you know, using that feedback, that should really shape some of those broadcasts a little bit more than they are.
Well, what I wanted to watch wasn't the WGC. I don't need to talk too much, but what I wanted to watch was Victor Hovland.
Yeah, he was awesome.
Puerto Rico Open, famously, Martin Trainer won there last year. We've talked about that, and I do want to touch on another story with him in a moment. But yeah, Victor Hovland picked up his first win for a rookie this year. Hits a bomb on 18.
Yeah.
Just an awesome, awesome way to finish. I knew when he hit on the green, I just had a feeling he was just going to
make it.
And he did. He gave it juice. That thing was at least 8 feet by if he didn't hit the back.
Yeah,
of the
cup. I think a lot of people were in that camp. Obviously, it's been talked about. You know, first Norwegian player to win on tour, 17th career start. So you know he's off and running. I've got a poll going on Twitter now. I haven't looked at it yet, but I set it out today as you know how many wins do you think Victor Hovland's going to have by the end of his career? And you know people are big on him. They think, you know what, this guy obviously won the 2018 U.S. Amateur. They're big on this guy. He played at Oklahoma State, played well there, and obviously was a top amateur, has shown his ability. And we talked about him last year on the show, and will he get his card? Remember talking about that?
I guaranteed it for the record.
Yeah, and there we go. You know what? He's got a place on the tour for a couple years at least. So nice to see that win. And, you know, again, this sort of opposite field events, this just shows us why some of these opposite field events have some value. Certainly a lot of people were talking about being more interested in that broadcast and seeing how Victor Hovland was going to do rather than, you know, maybe another player getting their seventh win or another player getting their eighth win. These are cool stories to follow as well.
Yeah, way better story watching Josh Teeter.
Yeah,
you know, finished second.
Yeah.
And the interview after, super emotional, held it back really well. Then watching Bryson versus Patrick, hate versus hater.
Yeah.
And then after they finish up, Bryson's got his arm around him and he's all buddy-buddy. It's like, oh, I feel like we belong together because...
Co-workers.
Because everyone hates us. It's like, it's comments like that, why everyone hates you. I'd rather watch Puerto Rico Open. I'd rather watch these stories. These are life-changing stories. The WGC was created to make more money for these guys, which I get. That's awesome. You can
not that the tour was mentioning it. I mean, you know, 1.82 million, but you didn't hear that. You heard 550 FedEx points. Is that what you heard?
Which, going back to what Peter Costas talks about,
totally.
He talked about that in that interview. Yeah. Literally, he talked to a guy, I think it was Joachim Niemann at the Greenbrier. And he said, you know, you're in the Masters, you're in this tournament, you're in that tournament. And then he got spoke to after because he didn't mention the FedEx Cup.
Yeah.
No one cares about the FedEx Cup in January.
No, not
February,
really.
You know, last September. It's silly.
And again, that's that feedback sort of realm. I mean, you can't just, I get it. You know, they're putting up $75 million total, you know, as a sponsor for the tour. It's big money that they're involved with the tour. But, you know, it's really hard to be palatable over and over again, especially that early in the year and for people to be thinking about it. So, yeah, that's great. But don't put it at the top of the list as the biggest thing that they win.
No, these Puerto Rico Open tournaments are the life-changing stories out there, absolutely. And I mentioned Martin off the top, and I'm giving no laying up, just tons of credit. But a couple episodes ago, I got a couple texts from a couple buddies saying they're ripping apart your boy Martin Trainer on the podcast. So I check it out, and obviously he had a big stretch where he was missing tons of
21 cuts he missed.
Yeah, exactly. He's aware of it. He was joking afterwards. Sure. You know, we should have a party once he made the cut at Riviera. They go on and they say, unknown tour player, and I'm just going to call it who this tour player is. These guys are best friends with Max Homa. I'm going to say there's only one guy out there that would be the unknown tour player that would say it, but said, these are my words, these aren't your words, so don't worry about it.
Yeah.
That said, you know, if you could beat Martin Trainer 4 out of 5 times on the if you went out and played against him to one of the guys on the whoever on no laying up. And I get there's a couple guys on there that might be scratch plus ones, whatever.
Yeah, but even then, that's nothing.
You're not beating them.
No.
You're not beating them 4 out of 5 times. Maybe you're beating them 1 out of 5.
Yeah.
Sure. You may beat Max Homa 1 out of 5. You may beat Tiger Woods 1 out of 5 if things go wild. It was just a stupid take for a guy that, yes, has struggled for the last while.
Yeah.
But in the last, you know, 18 months has won on the Latino America Tour, twice on the Corn Ferry Tour, and a PGA Tour win.
I was laughing because Puerto Rico Open was this week, so he was the defending champion there. The Corn Ferry Tour goes to Mexico this week for the El Bosque. He's the defending champion there. So, I mean, you got to respect the guy. And, I mean, you know, this goes back to even the players. You know, we talked about you know, Reed and DeChambeau or whatever, I respect their skill. There's nothing about it, but there's a separation there, and we can get into it more later, but there's a separation there between respecting someone's ability and not liking their character and everything that they do that way. So that said, you know, talking about Martin, you can't disrespect this guy just because he missed 20 cuts. I mean, he's not a chop.
Is he struggling? Sure. Absolutely. Yeah, sure. He's not going to deny that.
But plus one is not going to go out and beat him. Sorry.
Absolutely not. Especially on those conditions, you know, the length that these guys play at, it's just not happening. It was an awful take. Maybe we'll get his opinion one day on it, or maybe not. Probably isn't even worth his time. I don't even think we're worth his time anymore, let's be honest. but you kind of touched on an interesting subject point, and you mentioned it earlier to me, like, can you actually separate admiration, for the you know, that pro golfer with great skill, even though, you know, they're kind of an idiot, you don't like them, you don't like the way they conduct themselves. Patrick Reed's the perfect example. Tiger of the
past, I
guess.
There's been lots of players over the years.
Bubba at some point. Right. I mean, if you go over, you know, to the ladies tour, I'm sure there's some ladies out there that come to mind. But are you able to separate those two as well as, you know, maybe the social media folks are?
Well, for me, I have to be objective. And, you know, as a journalist, you have to look at it. And I look at it from a skill standpoint. I mean, if they're a skilled person and they're an incredible player, I respect their talent. I might not like their character, but I think I can separate it too. Where it becomes a little bit dodgy is when we start to talk about the fact of cheating accusations. Mm-hmm. And if they are founded, you know, in the fact that they are proven, then that says that you're not doing what you're doing by the same rules as everyone else. And, you know, where I think this will start to become a bigger issue is when we get to the gambling stories, when we start talking about the PGA Tour getting involved with gambling and stuff more. I mean, if you're betting on players, I think you're going to want to know that they're all playing by the same rules, and that, you know, somebody's not fudging one thing one way or the other. So, that's where things get muddied a little bit. But generally, you know what, I don't look too much at the person's character. That's not part of the narrative. If I'm writing a story about, you know, a tournament, if they had success and they did it, you know, based on their skill, well, fine. I can respect them for that. I don't have to necessarily like their personality or like what they do in real life. And it goes both ways. I mean, if they look at the media, they have to respect the media members for doing their job and taking care of things. If they don't like the person personally, well, that's just a whole nother element of it.
Well, I guess you're a good journalist, and I'm who I am, and I completely disagree on that. Sure. And for myself, I agree with what you're saying.
I know what you're saying.
Makes absolute great sense. But if I'm going to come on here, and if I don't like Patrick Reed, which I don't, somebody chirped me because I was going on, like, I bet you if he calls you up and says, hey, do you want to caddy for me next week, I actually genuinely would say no.
But that's a different story. That's not about respecting someone's ability. That's having a personal relationship where you're gonna have to work with somebody. Yeah. So that does come down to their character, right?
That's fair. But like, even on this podcast, like, even when I'm watching golf, I'm not gonna watch the golf if these are the guys that are up there. I want to root for a guy that's, you know, I trust played by the rules the entire round. Yeah. Now at this point, I can't trust anything Patrick Reed does for an entire round.
Well, no, certainly going to question it.
Yeah, especially at the end there. That's the only time you can, because the cameras were on him every single shot. And you best believe they're going to be focusing on him and zooming in real close on the ball, when he addresses the ball, the lies. I think there's a lot of stuff coming out from it. And I think I like this about the tour right now, is these guys calling each other out a little bit more, with Brooks Koepka now and Peter Costas coming out there. But I can tell you that the tour hates this.
Well, the tour does, because it's about their reputation, and they want to make sure that it's, you know, as clean as possible or whatever. I mean, that's like most corporations, they're going to be trying to do that as well. But, you know, if facts are facts, you can't necessarily hide them forever. That's just the way it is. As far as the players are concerned, you know what? You're protecting the field. You're protecting your own interest as far as the money that you're playing for. I mean, if I'm playing against you and we get done the round and you tell me you shot the same score as me, but I know that you cheated on something, that's not kosher, right?
No, we're gonna have have words.
Yeah,
probably.
Definitely.
We're going to have some words. One last thing about the WGC that stuck out to me. It was during the final round, Justin Thomas had that weird issue where his ball was up against the rake. He moved it. They called over the rules official. Did you see this?
No, I didn't see
so
that.
The first rules official came over, and he clearly was a Spanish-speaking rules official as his native language, his first language. And he comes over, and he says to Justin Thomas, "I think you just play it as it is."
Ooh.
And it's funny because Justin Thomas's caddy, you see his eyes roll, and he actually grabs the bag and walks away for a bit because you can tell he's about to do it. And Justin Thomas is like, "Well, can you just call for a second opinion?"
Right.
because I need to know. He ended up, that was the rule. He just played it where it was, and there was no penalty.
That's just a bad phrasing for a rules official, for sure.
And it's like, this guy's a head rules official. He's won on the final round at a WGC.
Ooh.
It was hard to see it. Just a caddy and player nightmare, and especially for a caddy. Now the caddy has to get your guy to reset. He's got to be like, okay, no, it's good. Don't worry about it. Because now if I'm Justin Thomas, I'm like, well,
you're doubting
I'm
it.
Thinking it
yeah,
the whole time.
Yeah.
Am I going to get Dustin Johnson at the end of the round where they come up to me and say, hey, it's a one-stroke penalty or you're done or you actually it's DQ because you didn't play it from where you're supposed to. So I just thought that was a funny little thing that came out from the week. There was another couple of golf tournaments happening this week and a huge, impressive win going on in Australia, probably one that you didn't see on TV. Why don't you give us a quick rundown?
Yeah, it wasn't. Stephanie Caracal, and actually I had to look that up. If you see her name, I had to go and dig up how to pronounce it. It was a player that had actually seen her name before because she played in the Canadian Amateur last year and tied for 32nd. I know she's up to, you know, top 90 in the world as far as an amateur. She's won the Australian Masters, I guess they have it, or the Masters. Anyways,
something like that. Let's call it that.
Yeah, there's like a couple of key events in Australia that she has won. Was playing in this Ladies European Tour event in Australia, and boy, oh boy, she was rolling along. Had a couple-stroke lead overnight going into the final round. A lot of people thought, oh, how's this going to work out? She's a 19-year-old amateur, prospective pro. And you know what? She shoots 65 in the final round, ends up at 22-under, wins by 8 with her father as a caddy. And then it looks like now she might turn pro as early as this week. And, you know, pretty impressive. And it continues the strong run of Australian players and how they're playing in the world this year.
Yeah, and there was another fellow Tee Talk podcast wow, finding my words. Played this week. Unfortunately, had a rough first round, but Hannah Hellyer's down there playing in Australia.
Yeah.
Went 79-69, quite the gap, but she's been grinding out in Australia for the last couple weeks.
Yeah, there's four Canadians that were in there playing in that event. Robin Doig was the only one that made the cut and got through. Robin Doig from Seaforth, Ontario, the famous Doig family, and she got through there. And then Megan Osland and Anna Young is down there as well. So we've got representation there, two from Ontario, one from Saskatchewan, and one from BC. So if people want to pay attention to the LET Tour and the Australian Ladies PGA Tour, because this is a co-sanctioned event, they're having some success down there, and they've been fun to follow as well. Their social media has been fun as they've been touring their way around Australia. They're all four fine players and fun to watch.
Absolutely. We have more ladies game to talk about. Who's our guest on the podcast?
Our guest today is Casey Ward, who I've known for quite some time. Casey's a PGA of Canada professional. She's the head teaching professional at the Credit Valley Golf and Country Club in Mississauga. Very interesting background, and I think people will enjoy our interview with her. All right, we want to welcome to the Tee Talk podcast Casey Ward, who's a longtime friend. She's a PGA of Canada professional, the head teaching professional at Credit Valley Golf and Country Club in Mississauga. She was also the 2018 PGA of Canada Mo Norman Assistant Professional of the Year. Welcome to the podcast, Casey.
Thank you for having me.
Now, your background's a little bit different than most people that probably get into the golf pro side of the business. You did grow up in Picton, Ontario, and I guess that's how we got to know each other a little bit and used to cross paths as you'd play some golf. But why don't you tell people a little bit about your upbringing in Picton, Ontario?
Yeah, obviously that's kind of where I started playing at the Picton Golf and Country Club. And, you know, just a little place. I was the only pretty much the only girl that played golf for any consistent period of time. And, you know, just grew up playing golf with my parents and then went on to do a degree at Queen's in kinesiology, and continued on that path kind of on the educational side of things, but golf being always at the forefront. You know, started out competing as a junior and continued on to provincial and national events and played at Queen's. And then really it turned out that golf was more my research passion than anything going through school. So it kind of took the playing and the research side of things and then somehow ended up where I am today.
Somehow teaching. You say somehow is how you say it, but you know,
it was never in the plan.
Yeah,
that's why I say that I had no intentions of ever turning professional or anything like that. And actually, I probably have you to thank, Scott, for a little bit of a nudge at one time.
A little bit, maybe an hour and a half phone call as I crossed the 407 one day, right?
Something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Now, obviously, as you said, you grew up playing, you know, with your parents and at Picton and being sort of the only girl that was there. And now you worked at the shop there too, right?
I did for quite a number of years, all through my time at Queen's, basically. And then after that for a couple of years and kind of, you know, got my start. Not a big club at all, but had quite a bit of involvement there.
Okay, now we're going to get to the good stuff here because you're fairly modest, but after you got done at Queen's, you decided to pursue a master's and, you know, decided to do it at a Cal State Fullerton, which is, you know, not the normal route for a lot of people. And I guess why don't you tell us a little bit why your decision to go there, and we have a few questions regarding some of the things that you did there.
Sure. It was actually kind of an odd situation. I was, after I finished at Queen's, I wasn't really quite sure what I was going to do. I knew that I wanted to probably pursue some more research and golf related and in the biomechanics side, but I also really wanted a little bit of time off as well. So I took a couple of years off and I was working at the pro shop there in Picton. And I happened to tell a member that, you know, this is what I want to do. I want to do golf biomechanics research. And that was like something that really I'd never, there, it wasn't happening or really out there at the time. And this member was like, oh, my son does that. I was like, what? Like, what are the chances we're in Picton? Someone does that. And I'm happened to be with her father. And it turned out it was Scott Lynn, his father. And he was like, yeah, he's in California at Cal State Fullerton and you should meet. And, it kind of happened that Scott was at Queen's for a period finishing up his PhD, I believe, right when I had started. And our paths maybe crossed for a minute. Anyways, I went down to Cal State Fullerton, and that was a great experience and got to work with Scott and did tons of golf-related research, which was terrific. And they basically had the draw there was that the lab it was one of the only golf kind of biomechanics labs in North America, let's say, at the time.
Yeah, for people that are not familiar, I mean, Scott Lynn is heavily involved with, as you mentioned, golf biomechanics, runs a lot of the certification stuff for Swing Catalyst. He's well known in the teaching community, great presenter, knows his stuff. And obviously, if there's somebody to work under or with, one, it's nice to do it with somebody that's also from Picton as well, also went to Queen's, but just happens to really be focused on exactly what you wanted to do as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there you worked with a lot of, I know we were having a lot of texts when you were down there because there were some different things that were happening and you were getting some neat opportunities to work with elite athletes and they weren't always golfers as well. And one that comes to mind was having a certain UFC fighter in your lab and learning from him and what he does. I'll let you tell us who it was. I know who it is, but why don't you get into that story and tell us what it was all about?
Yeah, that was the notorious Conor McGregor, the Irish UFC fighter. And I think I was just in the right place at the right time. And we filmed a Fox Sports special kind of program on sports science. And I got to spend the whole day with him. He was quite the character. As if you've seen him on TV, he's, you know, kind of bouncing off the walls and very, charismatic guy and did all these crazy moves, and he wouldn't stand still as we were trying to marker him up with, you know, kind of like 100 different reflective markers. And but it was pretty neat to have that caliber of athlete in front of you and doing, you know, just crazy things that, you know, I'm not sure that the human body should be able to do. But yeah, it was a very cool experience, and to see how a show like that is produced and kind of the things that they look at and do. I'm not sure that, you know, all of it is quite as it seems, maybe, but
nice.
there's some TV aspect to it.
What did you learn from him as an athlete that other golfers could relate to?
Oh, I think if you look at him, he just takes such care of his body. That's like his temple, it's his business and everything. Just the you know, he's so fit, has just like 0% body fat, probably something like that, but
same.
Really yeah just like the rest of us. And you know, just that as an athlete, that's his business, and he goes about it and takes care of himself that way.
So is he the same person you see on TV? Obviously, now I'm asking you to explain the UFC and how they market fights, and that's not your expertise, but just give us a little glimpse. Is he who we see on TV when he's trying to market a fight and make it as crazy as possible? Or was there a point in the day where you're like, oh, there's an actual normal human being here that actually can hold the conversation?
No, I don't think so. He was just as crazy as you would see on TV. Like, really, it was very difficult trying to get these markers on him. And he was just like constantly moving around and hopping everywhere. And like, he wouldn't sit still. And this thing, it went on from probably like 7 in the morning to at least 7 at night. And I don't think he stopped moving that whole time.
That's crazy. Now you did manage to get a few golfers into that lab. I know we were exchanging some texts one time when you had Mike Weir in there. I mean I don't know what you can talk about as far as, you know, what you guys were doing from a study standpoint or anything like that, but you know, what's the experience in bringing in a golfer there? Is it a case of, you know, you're asking them to come in, or they're inquiring about, you know, maybe they want to find out more about their biomechanics? What's the situation?
It was some of both. In research, it's really like kind of a tricky thing. So for my thesis projects, which I tried to do kind of a couple different studies in one, because it was really hard to get people. I mean, especially I'm coming from Canada, and I'm in this kind of foreign place. I don't really know very many people. So I was trying to recruit people from wherever I could possibly get them. Like, I was desperate. Pretty much. So at some points it was like, you know, the janitor, oh, you play golf? Yeah. Okay. Well, come on in. I would like to put these electrodes on your butt. And the whole thing's going to take about 2 hours. Are you cool with that? Yeah. Okay. Well, great. But we also had like Dana Dalquist.
Yep.
We were fortunate. He's in Long Beach. He would bring a lot of his players in. And that was kind of a really neat relationship. At the time, I really had no idea who Dana Dalquist was, and now I know. But at the time when he was standing in front of me, I was just like, oh, this guy seems right to be quite knowledgeable. But he brought a lot of players in. So, you know, there was a bit of both, just really trying to find people, and then other great players who wanted to come in and be tested.
Now, you ended up presenting some of your work at the World Scientific Congress in Australia. How was that for you? I mean, that was an interesting experience, I think, from the academic side of it, to go and present that. I mean, again, at this point, you're not really thinking about, you know, being a golf pro, but, you know, how was that experience for you?
It was really neat. I basically hemmed and hawed about going for a while. And it was, I think the conference was in September and it was like late August. And I was thinking, oh, should I go or not? And I think my parents were like, you should probably figure this out because a plane ticket is pretty expensive. But I wanted to go because I saw the lineup of people who were speaking, and I thought, I don't know if I'll have an opportunity to meet some of these people. So I made it my mission to, if I was going to go all the way across the world, that I was going to say something to, for instance, Mario Lafortune, who is the head of Nike research and development. And, I did that, and I got some really cool opportunities out of it. I got to go present some research that I ended up doing for Nike at the Oven in Texas. And so lots of great things came out of going to Australia, in addition to getting some experience actually like speaking at a conference, which was the first major conference I'd spoken at.
So that all wraps up. School all wraps up. Scott obviously knows the story. Myself and the listeners don't. How do you go from putting these things on the janitor golfer guy's butt to deciding, you know, I'm going to go in a different direction, stick with golf, but I'm going to go into the golf professional side of things?
Yeah, I think it took me, like, I really thought that I wanted to be a researcher and work for a company like Nike or Adidas. And I did this big footwear study for Nike, and that was kind of, I thought that's where I wanted to go, but it turned out that it was really hard to get a job, especially being a Canadian and trying to apply to companies in the US where visas are complicated and whatnot. But I wanted to do something in golf. And then I ended up doing some consulting jobs. I worked for BodyTrack. I make the force and pressure mat, and doing some odd kind of biomechanics consulting work. And then took up a job with Golf Ontario and their high performance teams for a season, and kind of got my hands wet more in the coaching side of things, and discovered that I was getting just as much enjoyment out of seeing other people succeed and helping them as I did my own game. And that's kind of where I started to think about turning professional, not being an actual profession for me. It seemed like a decent way to make money, and, you know, something that maybe wouldn't be for the long term, but would be something to consider as like a stepping stone. So
yeah, and I remember seeing you. We ran into each other in Myrtle Beach. You were there for the Golf Ontario camp. Besides me trying to, you know, crash a golf board into the bush, I think one morning that you guys had to witness. But you seemed to be enjoying yourself with the players and the team. And I remember observing that and thinking, you know, she's pretty good at this. I mean, she's great as far as the research and knowledge and a heck of a player. But you really seemed to be getting a personal joy out of it. Was that the case?
Yeah, it certainly was. And it was a great opportunity to kind of use all these things that I had learned at school. Like, even though my focus was in biomechanics, both my degrees are in kinesiology. And so I ended up, you know, I took lots of courses in motor learning or sports psychology, nutrition, things like that, where in coaching, I could kind of tie that all together into that in a bigger scale of performance. So it was neat that way. And the relationships I really enjoy. So it's been a great fit. I have like no regrets at all. So unfortunately I can't hang that one over your head, Scott.
Well, I know as a result of it though, as well, that, you know, you've gotten into the golf pro side of it, but you kept your hand in playing. Obviously you were, a fine amateur player. I believe it was the quarterfinal of the U.S. mid amateur that you got to, and you won an Ontario mid amateur, but there was different opportunities when you turned pro, and you were able to play in, you know, Canadian Women's PGA Championship. And then a great thing happened last year for you, and the fact that you got to play in the Canadian Women's Open. And, you know, why don't you tell us the story of that experience, how you got in, and then what it was like for you?
Sure. That is a story that I don't mind telling. It's probably the highlight of my golf career, and just such a great experience overall. I'd always had in the back of my mind that, you know, it would be kind of cool to try to qualify at some point and just to do it. I didn't want to have a regret at someday that I should have tried to qualify. So this past year when the qualifier was at Scarborough, I figured, well, this is probably not going to be any closer, and maybe a good opportunity to do so. And I think, you know, I'd seen other club professionals like Linda Shepherd at Barcoven out in our way. She'd played before, and that kind of, I always thought in the back of my mind, I'd really like to do that. It seemed like such a neat experience. So I kind of bit the bullet and at the last minute decided to play in the qualifier. And my thinking being like, if I have the round of my life, maybe I could get in, but, you know, really it's just do it so that I can say that I've done it and whatnot. So Had my dad caddy for me, as he usually did. And this time I actually told him, like, Dad, I don't really think my chances are very good. So it's a long way for you to come for just a day, and you really don't have to do it. But he was insistent, and kind of like every time I showed up in the morning at Scarborough, and he was waiting for me there in the parking lot, ready to roll.
Like a good
And
caddy.
Like a good
yeah,
caddy.
yeah.
Like a good
It's
caddy and a good dad. Yeah.
pop the trunk, get it out of the trunk, do your job.
Yep, he was great. He was, just knows my style and everything, and lots of experience on the bag. So, it more than anything, it was just a good excuse for us to like spend an afternoon together. So we played, and round went fine, whatever. But at the end, kind of, I didn't feel like I'd had the round of my life. So, probably didn't figure I'd get in, and neither of us really knew what I'd scored. So in the scores tent, I think I shot even that day, and I was like, oh, okay, great. So I pop out. My dad's like, how'd you play, or what'd you shoot? I was like, even. He's like, oh, but 71 got in. And he's like, oh man. So we were disappointed for like about 30 seconds, probably 15, and then we were both like, ah, but it was a great day and whatever. We had lunch on the patio and stuff, and so it wasn't until kind of on my car ride back, and he went back home to Picton and stuff, that I got a call from the tournament director, telling me that they were going to offer me the very last spot in the tournament, as a, I guess, sponsor's exemption for being the top Canadian in the Monday qualifier. So needless to say, I was elated, and called my dad right away, asked him if he could turn around and come back. So that was it was quite it was just like I was over the moon, and obviously you can probably still hear that I'm pretty excited
Yeah,
recalling it.
I mean, it turned into a dream week for you, and obviously became, even more important for other reasons eventually. But, what was it like to be somebody who, grew up as this, little girl in Picton, Ontario, and not even really, you're playing golf, but you're not really thinking about playing with the best professional players in the world. But, you end up on that stage, and obviously it was a big stage, and the fact that the Canadian or CP Women's Open hadn't been in Toronto for a while, a lot of attention on, Brooke Henderson, a lot of other things that are going on. But what was it like for you to be in that bubble?
It was very interesting, because I'd gone to so many LPGA events growing up. As a kid, we always my parents and I, we'd go to upstate New York and either watch the Corning Classic, or can't remember, there was another one, and I was always on the other side of the ropes, right? And I'd be typically watching Laurie Kane, and the odd time I, kind of became friends with Laurie through just watching her in tournaments, and she kind of pulled me inside the ropes and stuff, and that was so exciting. But those were like that one week of the year I looked forward to the most. I just couldn't wait until every May we'd go to this LPGA event. So being on the other side and looking out at the stands was like just the coolest experience ever. And of course, going into the locker room and things like that, and seeing Julie Inkster sitting there, Pat Hurst, like I was more excited about those players than, seeing kind of my peers, I guess.
Sure.
I was, just starstruck a little bit. But yeah, I was, I guess, it was interesting just being inside, and kind of it felt like any other tournament once you got going. And as soon as I stepped onto the practice range, it was just kind of like, okay, this is just the same as anything else. And just there are a lot of stands, and there are people, and there are ropes on the outside and
Just
stuff. But
a little bit. And how did that help out with Lori? Because obviously you became friends with Lori eventually, and you mentioned there having that interaction with her. But again, she has become a good friend with you. But how did that help that week? Did she make it a little easier for you?
yeah, I think that I can't quite recall, but I remember sending her a text and telling her that I got in. And then I probably said, like, well, like, how do I even make it to the practice tee? Like, what do
Sure.
I do? How do I get a do I have to make a tee time to make like a practice round, or what do I do?
Amazing,
That
amazing.
was really my like biggest hang up. Like, how do I get on the course?
Right.
but yeah, she was great that week, and it was kind of cool to be playing in the same tournament as she was, obviously.
No, you've spent some time playing with her a bunch. You also caddied for her, did you not?
Yeah, in the last Manulife tournament in Waterloo.
And is there any stories from that? I think there might be one. Was there a head cover story or something, or was that
no
you?
That was Linda Shepherd.
Oh, that was
she
Linda
put the wrong,
yeah
she put right. the wrong head cover on, like, a switched the 3 and the 5 wood and then pulled out the wrong club at some point.
So you didn't mess up Lori at any time during the Manulife. Okay, all right.
No, I was, you know, practicing my math ahead of time, and I gave her a couple good reads, and her usual caddy Danny saw me read one birdie putt, so that was probably the highlight.
Better caddy than me, I guess. Doing math.
Yeah. Stefan tries to avoid the math. Oh yeah.
It's 17 plus 2. You got it.
So obviously now you're in a position that I guess you probably started thinking about the last couple of years, and now being a head teaching professional, what is it that you find joy in every day in doing that job now?
I think it's just the whole golf swing and golf performance. It's like one big giant puzzle to me, and I really like puzzles. And just thinking about how kind of to tailor the improvement and performance of each individual, using that kind of multifaceted approach that I have through my kinesiology and biomechanics degrees, and just treating, you know, each person differently and having to think about how they're going to learn and, you know, what's going to be the biggest bang for the buck in terms of making improvements and changes and whatnot. So I really enjoy that, trying to figure out this puzzle of making people better or just enjoying the experience a little bit more.
So for you, I mean, you know, we'll get to this. I know it might be a little tougher for you as far as I'm finding it tougher just about to talk about it. But your dad unfortunately passed away this past December, and obviously he was a big influence in your life. And I know he'd be certainly very proud of what you've done and what you've become. And, you know, what was his big influence on you? He was a golf course designer. People are not aware, Stephen Ward. And, you know, what was his impact on supporting you throughout your career and shaping the person you've become?
He was just always incredibly supportive and never really pressuring me at all into doing really anything, whether it was, you know, he wasn't one of those golf parents who was pushing me to go into tournaments, or if I didn't want to do it, then I didn't have to do it. But he was just very encouraging, and, you know, obviously he instilled a great love for the game in me. Growing up, it was pretty cool to be going to different sites with him. And even though at the time I was probably more fascinated by bulldozers and stuff like that, but just, you know, his enjoyment of creating courses and just seeing like how that all worked in his mind. I never, you know, I couldn't look at, you know, this big mucky field and figure out where a hole would go or how it would be laid out. But I was always just fascinated by how he'd come up with some of this stuff. But yeah, he's just, you know, the best guy. And probably, you know, I don't know anyone who had quite the father-daughter relationship mm-hmm. that we did. So certainly, you know, he provided me with some great tools. And so I'm very blessed that way.
Yeah, I mean, he was a heck of a caddy, that's for sure, and a heck of a supporter. And I think in seeing what you've, you know, become in the industry of being, you know, almost becoming a little bit of a leader and a model for other women in the game and other people in the game, not just women, but, you know, that aspect is pretty important as well. I know you've become an Adidas ambassador, and you're doing a lot of work with Leslie Hawkins, who's the general manager at Adidas Canada. What does that mean to you? And creating maybe some opportunities and some examples for women in the golf industry in Canada?
It's been absolutely fantastic to work with Leslie and the whole team at Adidas. She's, you know, I think they're just on such the right track and really trying to promote the women's game and think differently about it. And so, you know, I think they're really creating some opportunities, and that's all, I mean, one of the things that really hit home. Leslie said at one point was in a conversation was, you know, having more visibility for women in golf. And I mean, that means for me, you know, having more professionals just out there. I think the statistic is that women only make up 5% of PGA of Canada professionals. There's like less than 200 of us in the country. And yet we're trying to grow this demographic. Everybody knows that the women's side of the game is kind of where we need to hit next and to grow the game. But yet we have so many or so few professionals out there who can be seen and who, you know, it's hard to want to go into something if you don't see people who look like you or act like you. So I think there's huge potential for women to, you know, to become professionals. I hope that other maybe girls who are just growing up now can see what I'm doing and be inspired a little bit. That would be, you know, great to me.
What can men do to help that and be allies for the women and grow the women's game?
I think just thinking differently about the whole process, what it is like for a woman, let's say, to go to a golf course even. Like, it's not, the experience isn't very well set up for a woman. You know, they're more, you know, I mean, this is in all cases, but kind of like timid about, you don't really know where to go. A golf course, it's kind of like you just walk in and you're expected to know. There aren't signs necessarily, things like that, where, you know, I think like more consideration on that side. And, you know, kind of, if you can create connections for those who aren't in the profession, but, you know, maybe you have a way for a partner, sister, you know, cousin, whatever, to be encouraging and not just kind of, this is the place that I go on a Saturday and Sunday and, you know, please don't come here kind of thing. You know, I think there's kind of that stigma around it, is that this is where my husband goes, and like, I don't want to be a part of it sometimes.
And we talked about that with Lisa Longball a little ways back, and she told a great story about being at Pebble Beach and the starter telling her to move up a tee, even yeah. though.
And you've heard this story.
Yeah. I've heard this yeah, one.
Go back and listen to
it. She's heard it. Yeah. She's heard it live, so yeah.
Yeah, for anyone that hasn't, go back and listen to it. And I think that there's for all the funny stories there are of those, there's always the ones that aren't so funny and the people don't come back. So yeah. Just the encouragement just to say, bring more people there. I think that is a very easy thing that you can do is, you know, grab your friend that even showed slight interest in it, or your wife or your daughter, or whoever, and just bring them to the course. And, you know, even like I have a buddy that he played alone a lot. And he just was bored of being alone. So he just brought his girlfriend to the course and she sat in the cart for probably the first five rounds. But then eventually she hit a golf ball and hit another one and wanted her own clubs. And now, like, he sent me a video tonight of them at, you know, like an indoor driving range together. And she's got the itch. So I think that's a very good tip. Just bring somebody to the course and you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, hopefully. I think that as like PGA of Canada professionals, we have to do, and just professionals in general, have to really think about the, you know, when women come to a club and how we should be treating them and what experience you want to create. Because too many times it's kind of like that we get ignored, or I know that I get ignored. If I were with a group of guys, I would probably, you know, the person maybe in the pro shop is going to direct their conversation to them and not necessarily look at me, or, you know, just make an assumption that I'm not going to be a very good player, or I'm, you know, not familiar with the game, so I shouldn't be treated that way. Stuff like that happens too much, and, you know, we need to change that.
Do you blend any of that into your coaching? I mean, I know you have some unique clinics and things that you do, but, and I know I've had that experience. I've had some people come to me from a coaching perspective and just want to know, you know, if I go out on the golf course, where do I stand? What do I do? I mean, all the things that you talked about a little bit of almost going to play in the CP Women's Open and going, how do I get on the golf course? But do you find that for yourself? Do you see that among your students?
I've become, actually, I had some really great conversations with Jamie Steedman and then Patty Kelly at Toronto Ladies over kind of like the past probably 6 months or so. And they, I think they have some great insights because they're dealing with women coming into the game all the time and things that like I didn't think about, but now I absolutely am. Just like that, like, okay, so if you're coming, which I'm now implementing, so, you know, for instance, if it's having a clinic with, you know, women who have never been to the course, for instance, is saying like, now you're going to drive into the parking lot. When you pull in, you're going to see, you know, so-and-so on the right-hand side. They're going to be there to take your bag. Then you're going to park here, like giving just detailed instructions. Because like I was at the CP Women's Open, I had no idea like even where to park or what to do at all. Like we want that. And it makes you feel a little bit more at ease in a place that you're unfamiliar with. And in a sport that probably you don't know very much about.
Well, Casey Ward, I think you know where you're going now. You've done a great job and really appreciate you coming on and sharing your insights and sharing your story. I know our listeners will certainly appreciate it. And if they want to get a hold of you, how do they reach out and how do they find you?
I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Casey Ward Golf. That's probably the easiest way, or you can always find me through the Credit Valley website and send an email along.
Great. Thank you. Have a fantastic 2020 golf season.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Thank you, Casey Ward, for that great interview. Good message at the end there. Just, you know, start bringing the women in your life to golf courses. Doesn't matter. Just get them out there. Maybe they'll show some interest and we get more women playing the game. And, you know, we need more women professionals, clearly.
Well, I think part of the problem is, you know, as Casey outlined, is the fact that we always think of golf courses as a golfer. We don't look at it as a non-golfer would. And we don't realize, you know, the things that we don't think about, they're limitations, they're barriers. Mm-hmm. And as a result of it, people don't feel comfortable and then they don't want to be there. And, you know, we got to be as welcoming as possible. So, yeah, as she said, we just have to think about the game differently. And it's not a matter of having, you know, different tips and tricks and, you know, soccer balls and whatever. It's just first off making people comfortable. And, and that's the entry point to get them there.
It was a good message. You know, it reminds me, you know, in the summer you're playing with new people and, you know, you're trying to get them to, you know, speed up potentially, mm-hmm. you know, be aware, but, you know, you can do it in a better way.
Yeah.
I've definitely been probably somebody that could learn to do it in a better way and make it more of a inclusive environment, a teaching environment rather than, you know, we got to hurry up because they're there, right?
And that makes it intimidating, really.
Exactly.
For them, right?
You want to explain and actually teach and, you know, be patient because golf is a game where patience is, no matter whether you're playing it or you're with people, it's sure. tested, that's for sure.
Yep.
A couple of cool stories coming out of the weekend outside of, you know, the PGA Tour events going on. The LPGA is obviously off right now due to those health scares that we talked about. But you have a funny story about Colin Montgomery being spotted at a PGA Tour Superstore.
Yeah. Actually, I saw this on Twitter. It was kind of funny, and it got me thinking about a couple of things. But, I was in Phoenix. I guess the rain was coming down, and there's Colin Montgomery, you know, this guy who won, you know, a million money titles on the European Tour and obviously well known for, you know, sometimes being a little grumpy during his career, but certainly well known, let's just say that. And so he spotted on the putting green testing clubs in the PGA Superstore, and I just got to thinking, you know, that's kind of a weird situation. I mean, if you saw that happen, I mean, what would you do? I mean, would you gonna leave this guy alone? Would you, you know, like maybe get over near him and, you know, crack a comment maybe to get a conversation going? Or would you like all out go, hey, you know, it's Colin Montgomery. Let's go get a golf lesson.
No, I'm different. I think
everybody's different, yeah. but that's why it's interesting to think of the psychology of it and think, you know, what would you do if you saw that situation?
Everyone's just a person to me, and it doesn't really matter if you have, you know, all the money and all the PGA Tour wins or none. And, you know, as you know, if you're an employee of the store, just go over and I think you crack a joke and, you know, hey, do you want to get fit for that or as a little joke or something like that? And then just ask, you know, what's going on and probably leave him alone. If you need any help or not, he doesn't. He's going to feel it out and might buy a new putter. It reminds me a few years ago, Tyrell Hatton went into Golf Galaxy,
bought a putter.
And, you know, went out, shot 64 to this opening round. Like, it's not unusual. There's many stories of guys just doing it.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And we got to remember, these guys are – they're golfers,
yeah,
too.
Yeah,
and golfers
are
weird.
They're nuts like the rest of
us. Yeah, you know, you're waiting for a dinner reservation, and I probably was in this PGA Superstore when I was in Phoenix just a few weeks ago. You know, you're waiting for a dinner reservation. There's a restaurant nearby. They're usually in those, you know, subdivisions where there's all sorts of stores. I'll hop over there, hit a few putts. Why not, right?
Yeah, for sure. That's their thing. I mean, what's interesting, though, is that, you know, if you saw that person there, would you necessarily recognize them? Because the other side of it, too, is that certain characters among the pros you might recognize, or you think you'd recognize in person, but, you know, if they don't have their normal logoed hat on, if they're just dressed a little bit more casually and they're not sort of in context, sometimes you might not even know they're there, right?
Absolutely. Couple other things going on that I wanted to touch on. The big one I saw on Twitter tonight kind of caught me off guard a little bit. We've been hearing about this Premier Golf League.
Yeah.
Obviously, Phil is getting invested, I would think. He's been talking to them. If someone's going to pay Phil to do anything, he'll put his name on it.
Well, he played with one of their key figures at the Pro-Am when he was in Saudi. So, I mean, I guess that's sort of how he got involved with it. And you know,
Rory's made comments about it.
Rory's bailed on it, which I mentioned on the podcast last week. Unfortunately, you weren't there, so we couldn't debate it or discuss it. But, you know, he's basically said he wants to be on the right side of history, was his comment related to it. Does that mean that's the death knell to it? Not necessarily, but I don't know if this thing's going to even get off the ground.
Yeah, well, where they're talking about is where this money is coming from. And a lot of guys, it's, you know, it's not really our place to really speculate on where it's coming from, but, you know, it's probably not honest money. Let's say that. Sure. Why not? But, you know, I talked about it off the top about the coverage that they are proclaiming they are going to have and kind of this setup. And I'm just going to read these tweets real quick, get your take, and see, is this something of interest to you? Sounds good?
Sure.
Cool. So what is the PGL? Elevating everything we love about traditional tournament golf and a team event that delivers the passion and excitement of team sports. So they're saying in every event, there'd be 48 players, there'd be 18 events, 12 teams, one individual world champion, one team world champion. Cool. Sure. Why not?
Sure. Why
not? Bring more of a team aspect to it. So what would a PGL event look like? Well, they're going to do 54 holes of stroke play, a shotgun start on days one and two, which is like, why? Unnecessary.
I don't know about that.
A 2T start for the final day. Everyone wants to see the leaders going head-to-head down the stretch in the final round. You kind of get that anyway now, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
So how will the PGL team format work? So each team will have four players. All players compete all three rounds. The team captain picks which two players scores will represent the team before each round starts. What does that mean? Basically, you know, they're picking them. You know, he's our two players. Why is the third guy there then? That doesn't make any sense, but whatever. I don't really care. I'm going to keep going. You know,
please.
I'm going to skip a bit. The part that I thought is funny is it says, you know, what else will we see in a PGL event? And it's basically they're talking about the coverage, right? And they say, you know, shot link on every single hole. The players will wear team colors. They're claiming it'll be a faster pace of play. They use shorts as a way of marketing that. Shorts is going to be the big thing coming out.
Woo!
Uh-huh. And then they're saying that what they'll be able to do is you could follow one player. You could only watch one player. You could only watch one team. You want to just watch the leaders. You want to do split screen. This is all their claims they're basically making. And then they are going...
This sounds like us sitting in the basement trying to come up with our ultimate tour.
Yeah, exactly.
How's that?
Exactly what it sounds like. I read it and I was like, this is silly. The only thing that stood out to me was that dream coverage type of thing that they're talking about. And obviously, I think the PGA Tour, with the way they're going with betting, I think they'll eventually get there anyway, probably in a way. But what are your thoughts overall?
Here's my biggest thought. It's great to have this structure. Sounds exciting and everything. Who's going to play? Who are your players?
Yeah.
These guys, you've got to remember, if we look at the tours and how they're created now, guys want to play less, not more. Purses have gotten bigger and bigger. There's many, many, many opportunities to play for $10 million purses already on the PGA Tour. I get it. Some guys might get disgruntled every now and then with something the PGA Tour does. Technically, they own the PGA Tour if they're PGA Tour members, as it is. And obviously, you know, their current commissioner, Jay Monahan, obviously doesn't want to see players going over and playing this league. So who are you going to get to play this tour that's exciting enough that spectators are going to watch and be interested in? Because it's not like you need five players.
Yeah, and it's also, there's a... every single week, there's a PGA Tour event. Right. Every single week, there's a European Tour event.
Yeah.
These guys aren't going to bail on 1 week unless there's huge...
No,
huge,
Jay Monahan has said, forget it as far as the PGA Tour. If you're a PGA Tour member, you are not playing in this tour. And the same thing happened back in the day when Greg Norman was talking about a World League or whatever. Tim Fincham at the time basically said, hey, no way. If you're playing that, you're either playing that or you're playing this. So are you going to run away for something that's well established for decades, already has the sponsorship, already has the structure in place, for something that is basically sounds like a fantasy? I don't know. I just don't see it really happening. I don't see it getting off the ground. Could it? We'll see, but you're not getting it off the ground with second tier players. And I don't think you're going to get that many of the premier players running to play that, because frankly, you're also starting from the very start as far as, you know, history and tradition are concerned. And I get it. Players are playing for paychecks. They, you know, that's part of their job, but they also love the history and tradition of the game. And they love playing for certain championships and tournaments that are out there. They're interested in exhibition events that are every now and then, but this is not an exhibition event. They're intended to be.
Yeah. They're looking to start a tour here. And I don't see it happening. They have 6,000 followers on Twitter. Like, it's not going anywhere. Sure, you're talking about your dream coverage. That's going to be your selling feature to fans. It's not going to happen. So I wouldn't give this too much more thought.
No, I wouldn't either. And like I said, I don't think it's going to get off the ground. Certainly, it's going to be discussed a lot more in the next little while. They're going to try to make their push. Now, we shouldn't say, you know, when we talk about the money, you know, it's oil money. So we can't necessarily say it's, you know, it's not about, maybe it's more about the character of the people behind it rather than being the legality of it.
Sure. My wording may not have been perfect.
Yeah, but whatever the case, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to excite everyone. Obviously, we've seen that already with Rory McIlroy saying, you know, this is maybe not the right side of history that I want to be on. And the same will probably go with other players as well. I mean, really, like I said, when it comes down, they're not going to get Tiger.
No.
I hate to say it. I mean, Tiger's, you know, they'll be lucky to see Tiger play, you know, 12 events in a year total. You know, he's not going out to play 30 or 40 events.
No. And speaking of Tiger, have we got to the point in golf where, you know, the event really isn't important unless Tiger plays at it? And what I mean by that is, like, he's playing 12 events. He's very selective, and they're not small. Like, he's not picking small events.
No.
They are very good events. He's not playing this week in the Honda.
No.
He didn't play. Him not going to a WGC as well. I mean, it was in Mexico. You know, security concerns when you're Tiger, maybe.
Yeah.
But, like, he's not even playing in those.
Yeah, but the thing is, he played in it last year, and I don't think there was any issue that way. I mean, but I think, you know, Charlie had a tournament.
Yeah.
Charlie had a tournament.
That's awesome.
There's video out there of him being out in the golf course with Charlie, and I think Charlie had a tournament.
That's
so
awesome.
You know what?
But I do think there's a point to be made that, like, there's so many events, and the only ones that people are really paying attention to, and it's not a coincidence when he's at the event, they're probably the best fields every single week. Like, he's not going to play again until the Players.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, right? Like, he's not playing next week.
Well, that probably lends itself to part of the PGA Tour's mission at this point, then, when they're starting to deal with, you know, maybe, you know, trying to gloss up the Patrick Reeds of the world. They're trying to do character development. They have, you know, this is really about, in an entertainment business, you've got to have a cast of characters.
But why are you barking up the Patrick Reed tree?
Well, I mean...
I don't want to bring this guy back.
Yeah, it's like, another member, but not even him for an example. They need to develop all their characters, but they also have to do it in a way that's earnest as well. I mean, you can't just force it on people, but, you know, you're not going to hide away from the Tiger story, but you've got to find ways to make things compelling for golf fans. And that's, as we've talked about, is making them... making it more palatable for them and things they want to see. I was thinking about it this week. I mean, you know, what are the other things that we want to see out of a broadcast? I mean, if there's things that we want to see and what fans want to see, they need to pass that on to the PGA. Don't just rage on Twitter about it. I mean, that gets some noise. But, you know, if there's things that you want to see, I mean, broadcasters have to hear that. And at some point, the PGA Tour, within the restrictions that they have with the broadcast partners, have to realize that they're going to have to do some things as well.
Absolutely. Well, it is, as I mentioned, it is the Honda Classic week. Any buzz for you? It's kind of a, I feel like it's an off week tournament, probably not the biggest, deepest field out there. A lot of good Canadians in the field, but.
Yeah, I mean, Connors, Gligic, Hearn, Hughes, Sloan are in the field. I didn't double check. Adam Svensson was 67 in the Monday qualifier. I'm not sure if he got through, but he was right up there. But whatever the case, you know what, for me, one, the bear trap drinking game. I guess if you want to get involved with that, you're going to hear the word.
I always get the bear trap and the snake pit mixed up. One's the Valspar, one's yeah. The Honda Classic.
I'm not a big fan of the golf course. The Champion Course at PGA National, you know, it's 15 holes with water. It's, you know, obviously.
Florida golf.
It's very Florida golf. So, you know, Keith Mitchell, great to see him win there. Got a dramatic final hole. Obviously, there's lots of opportunities to hit a ball in the water in the last few holes in. I can't say it's going to be the most compelling weekend for me to get to the TV to watch this. I'll probably maybe try to find something else to watch. And obviously, you know, as we said, no Tiger in the field, no Rory in the field. Doesn't quite become as compelling as some of the other events.
You know what's going to be compelling?
What's that?
Our next segment. We have birdie or bogey coming up.
We do.
We got the mailbag to wrap it up. We got a full mailbag this week. A lot of questions in there. And then we'll hit the tip with the pro. For all the pros out there, like Casey Ward. All right, so we're going to take a quick break. We'll come right back. All right, birdie or bogey is back. I take it you didn't do one of these alone last week?
Nope, pretty hard to do.
That would have been riveting radio.
It would have been. Did a mailbag, but no birdie or bogey.
Well, we're back this week with it, so let's get into it. Golf clubs, recently there's some stories out there converting their curling rinks to alternate facilities, indoor golf, fitness, or, you know, event centers. Is there anyone that you saw in particular that brought this one to your attention?
Yeah, well, I've seen Weston in Toronto has been doing it, and I was having a discussion with a couple other courses that are considering it as well. Obviously, this is a Canadian problem more than anything. We don't see a lot of curling rinks in the U.S. Affiliated with golf courses, a few of them, but not too many. I think this is just a symptom of adaption, really. I mean, every golf course, every sports facility, recreational facility is making adaptions to their business models, to the needs of their customers. It's a birdie for me, in the fact that it's a sign that maybe some clubs are listening to what their customers want. And in their cases, maybe the curling is not as active anymore. There are other clubs that have closed their curling rinks, Scarborough, for an example, as well. We're seeing it at some of the private facilities. And in the case of Weston, they have converted theirs. They call it the Nest, I believe. And they have basically a full indoor, facility there, and you know, as a result of it, they've got a lot of members that make use of it over the winter time. They, you know, keeps their staff active, gives their assistant pros, associate pros, teaching pros,
gives them a job.
Yeah. Keeps the clubhouse active, so it keeps dining and things active this way. Other ones that have fitness as well, they're realizing that their members are spending money at fitness clubs already, so why don't they have that revenue coming into them? And they're trying to create a hub, a social hub, so that they fill the needs. I mean, customers have a problem, and golfers are the same. They want some place to do certain things, and that might be indoor activity and maybe curling, you know, especially with the cost of electricity, you know, a dwindling market, and maybe not the ability to get that revenue back with, you know, higher membership rates. So for some facilities, I think this is maybe a choice they have to make. And for me, I don't mind it at all. It's a birdie for me.
I don't really care, personally. It's, yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head. If it makes sense revenue-wise, then do it. If you're not getting the revenue for curling, make it on golf. And if it's going to work, then do it. It's a birdie. If you're shutting down things that are in use just for to make it you're a full golf facility, maybe that's a bogey. But in this case, it sounds like these are all birdies to me. And again, I don't really care.
Yeah.
So let's move on. Sure. You mentioned this earlier this week. You actually tweeted it at one point. The PGA Tour broadcast basically avoided mentioning the amount of money that Patrick Reed was going to make and started with all the FedEx Cup points he was going
to. And this hasn't just been this week. It's been, you know, continual for quite some time now. You know, they have the standard rundown, what the winner is going to get during the week, you know, basically list what the exemptions they're going to get and what they're earning out of it. But they decide to avoid the money. And I don't know why they do it. I get it that, you know, FedEx sponsor put the points up there. That's fine. But why not put the money up there too? Yeah. I mean, you can put it in the list. I mean, I don't know whether they're ashamed that the money has gotten so high. I mean, WGC this week is $1.82 million for first prize.
Sweet.
You know, that's good. Yeah. You know what? They're touring pros. They're professionals. They're professional athletes. They're the best in the world. I expect them to make money. You know, you can't just hide it and gloss it over and just say, hey, they're going to win points. I mean, frankly, they're not spending points. They're not taking FedEx points and turning them in for cars at the Mercedes dealership. So, you know, why hide it? I mean, there's not really, to me, I don't see there's any point with it. You can mention both.
Absolutely. I agree with you. It's a bogey.
It's a bogey.
It's a bogey for me as well. Just go out there and have the money sponsored by, you know, Royal Bank of whatever. Who cares, right? There you go. Now you got to double down on your sponsor
money. It's almost like they're embarrassed by, you know, the fact that they're winning money. So, you know, I get the emphasis on the points because it's a sponsor, but don't obviously, you know, not include the money just because of that.
Here's a birdie. It doesn't matter. You don't even have to give your take. It's a birdie. If you haven't seen this, Charles Howell III. Speaking of money.
20 years in a row.
He has hit 20 years in a row with $1 million in earnings. Only him and Phil Mickelson, who is now 24 years in a row, have done that. That is a birdie. This guy is an ATM.
He surely is.
He's the ATM. People should just call him ATM. Like, there should, when he's on the leaderboard, it just should say ATM. This guy never really wins. We've talked about him before. Just a birdie.
Yeah, you know what? His game's amazing. Nice guy, works hard. The fact that he's done that is stunning. So two for one play. Oh, I'm checking in on Adam Svensson here. We shouldn't be doing live updates because I just want to see if Adam Svensson gets in the field. But I'll have
to update that later.
Sure.
But yeah, just and he's an absolute birdie. And Chucky three sticks. That's where we're at.
You got it.
So, birdie or bogey, golf course is doing renovations where they are eliminating bunkers from original designs.
Yeah, that's a birdie for me. I mean, I've been talking to Oliver Tubb and a couple other designers as well. And, you know, they're sort of going back and taking a look at some of the designs that are out there. And I wouldn't call it classic designs. They might have been designs that were created in the 80s and the 90s when, you know, some of the golf courses, we'll call them big hair golf courses, they kind of had the, you know, kind of a wild look. And I don't know what they were trying to do. Everything wanted to be 7,000 yards and you know, as many bunkers as possible. And it's just not realistic to maintain those over a long time. I mean, you get to 15 or 20 years later, it's a lot of money to redo those bunkers with the linings and everything. So starting to hear about more designs that are going back, designers that are doing retrofits, I guess, for those golf course redesigns, eliminating some of those bunkers, putting in some other features to make things interesting. And I'm good with it. I mean, really, they can still make a golf course difficult and challenging without having the bunkers, but generally in the end, they usually just end up punishing the players that are not very good, and you're just going to have a terrible time and a slower round too.
Especially the fairway bunkers.
Oh yeah.
Things that, like, you know, I'm going through my home course in my head of just thinking it doesn't matter which tee I play, that bunker's never in play, things like that. So you gave it a birdie. I'm giving it a birdie. I say this all the time. The golf course doesn't have feelings. Stop pretending the golf course has feelings.
That's a great way to put
it. I say it all the time when we're talking about, oh, you know, we can't have Augusta National win at -25. Nobody cares.
No.
The golf course doesn't have feelings. And especially the original design, the piece of paper it was drawn on, it doesn't have feelings either. Nobody cares. No. If the bunker's costing the company, the golf course, more money than it's actually worth out there and the fun of the game and the experience, then take it out. They've done it many times at my golf course and all around the area. Don't mind it at all.
Yeah, and I know of a design that was done on a, it was a resort, and I won't name it, but because what happened was they had the designer do the redesign, gave them the plan, and then the group that owned the golf course was doing the building, and they basically chopped out a bunch of the bunkers that the designer had put in there just because they looked at it and said, hey, you know what? We're a resort course.
Sheer cost alone of bunkers is insane.
We need to get people out of here in 4 hours. Mm-hmm. We don't need them in here playing in a sandbox like maybe Patrick Reed, for a long about a time, you know, taking extra time, getting extra frustrated. You know what? They're going to get their experience out of it. They're still going to enjoy the design. They don't need those extra 30 or 40 bunkers.
Rule for next week, birdie or bogey. This is off the cuff. We don't mention Patrick Reed's name.
I would love to. All right. I'm in.
Yeah, it's a birdie for you?
That's a birdie for me.
All right, I like it. Doesn't matter. This guy could do anything this week, and we're not mentioning him once next week. If the Players' Championship becomes a major, they're mm-hmm. talking about maybe next year. I don't know, maybe not. There's a lot of talk. They bring it up all the time.
Yeah. Well, the PGA Tour does not currently own or operate a major, so they want to operate
a
major.
Of course. So if the Players' Championship becomes a major mm-hmm. and they do not include the past winners of the Players' Championship as being major champions, is that a birdie or bogey for you?
That's a birdie for me. I mean, I think really when we start to look at when events become major championships, and we'll go back and look at things like, you know, the Western Open used to be a major. I mean, the U.S. Amateur, the British Amateur used to be considered majors. In the period of time when they're considered a major, they are a major and they can go on your record. But we don't have to retroactively go back and declare something. So, you know, if the Players' Championship becomes a major next year, it's from that year on.
I see what you're saying. It's a good argument. I'm not going to deny your argument.
I think it's your choice.
Yeah, I think it's a bogey, though. It's 1 year to another. You know, we're talking about, you know, say the Western Open.
So are we going to go back then and look at, you can take anybody. Jack Nicklaus won Western Opens when it was not a major.
But the Western Open isn't switching over. Are you talking about back then? I see what you're saying. Mm. I'm seeing what you're saying. But the Players' Championship, maybe this is just recency. We got chirped for saying recency bias too much.
Oh,
by the way.
Perfect. Great.
Every time we say it, we're supposed to take a drink. But maybe it's recency bias being the Players' Championship, being called that fifth major over the last 20 years or whatever. And I don't know. I'm saying it's a bogey. I just think it's silly that 1 year, you know, it's not a major. The next, I actually am fully on board with it never becoming major. Let's just leave it at four. But I can see it. I can see it becoming five. I get it from the PGA Tour's perspective. They want to own one. Meh. Yeah. I'm struggling with this one. I'm calling it a bogey, though. I don't like it.
All right. Fair enough.
Last one.
Yeah.
This has happened over the last couple of weeks on
Love
the PGA
this.
Tour. It hasn't been showing up. A lot of people wanting to see it, but golf TV broadcasts do not show poor shots. And we look back to Riviera. We had Harold Varner III.
Tops it off the tee on 10.
Off the tee on 10. There's people on Twitter basically, you know, asking, where is it? Where is it? Yeah. They're claiming they didn't have it. They had it. So is this a birdie or bogey for you missing the bad shots?
Yeah, it's a definite bogey for me. I want to see those shots. And part of the reason I want to see those shots, because as a coach, it sets a standard for people to realize that PGA Tour pros and LPGA Tour pros and European Tour pros, they don't play the game perfectly. Every single shot is not perfect. So a common question that I'll have for people all the time is say, you know, what's the average distance that a PGA Tour player hits it proximity to the hole on a 75 to 100-yard shot? And, you know, they'll come back, 5 feet. You know, it's 19 is what it is.
Yeah.
But they'll come back all the time with these unrealistic things because, you know what, they see highlight packages. That's what they see all the time, highlight package. And again, this comes back to a tour trying to gloss themselves and say, yes, we're the highly skilled players. Yes, they are highly skilled players, but they're not perfect. And if you go to a live event, you'll see shanks and duffs and chips and shots hit out of bounds. And I mean, that's golf. That's what it is. And you know what? That makes it more relatable to the audience so that they go, hey, I can hit that shot.
Well, look at Justin Thomas last week.
Right.
The amount of shots he hit from under the trees, making it on the green, yeah. Amazing shots. Can you imagine they took those, you know, the tee shots that got him there? Like, oh, how did he end up here?
Yeah.
You got to show them all. I clearly, you said it was a bogey. It's a bogey for me as well. I think, you know, one of my favorite videos on YouTube, go on YouTube and type in Tom Kite and watch him. I believe it was the 92 something, PGA Championship. And he just hits this absolute shank right into a spectator. And it's just... No, I don't want to see people get hurt. But this guy, you know, Tom Kite is a
but
great...
But they're human. They're human.
Yeah, they're human. That's what you want to see. It's yeah. It's one of my... It's a hilarious video. Go and watch it. Tom Kite, I think it's called Worst Golf Shot Ever on YouTube. But I want to see those things. I want to see Harold Varner. I mean, you know he would have had a laugh
I mean,
at
no
it.
Other major league sport gets away from that. Again, going back to the one ball thing, but how many times have you seen a, you know, bloopers in baseball and in basketball and hockey?
Highlight reels every week on sports.
And you know what? They're entertaining.
Yep.
They're entertaining. So, you know what? Don't be afraid to show it. The product doesn't have to be polished. We have enough Instagram era out there as it is. Show us the other side of it.
I love it. Well, that is birdie or bogey for this week. Now it's time to open up the mailbag, Scotty. What questions do we have?
Yeah, she got full this week. Actually, I didn't actually get to open it up, and people had already sent in questions, which is great. We appreciate that. Keep them coming because we can always use them for further weeks as well. Some fun ones this week. I'll see how you react to some of these. But first one up, I don't know if you've seen this infomercial, and if you've turned on the Golf Channel, you definitely have. But
yep.
If your putting improved greatly, would you play an SK7 stand-up putter?
So the SK7 putter in the commercial, it allows you to put the putter down behind the ball, what you think is in line.
And this is not the first one to do
no,
it. And there's other ones on the market. Bloodlines, another company does it. Yeah.
Stand straight up. You can go stand behind your ball. It is legal. Rich and I talked about this on the previous podcast.
Yeah.
It is legal to use. So if my putting improved greatly, would I use the SK7 stand-up putter? You're absolutely right, I would use that. Why wouldn't you? You're telling me you're going to save... You say I save 5 strokes around off this? 2 strokes around? 3 strokes around? I'm going to say 3 is my minimum. I'm saving 3 strokes around using this? Absolutely. It's not ugly looking. It's not ugly looking. The actual putter head, it's just the process of looking like an absolute dweeb. I'm in, 100%.
You know what? I've probably played uglier putters in my life.
I don't have that pretty of a putter in the golf. Neither do I.
No, I remember I had an old STX putter that I used that was an on-set thing. And it was called The Thing. I called it The Thing.
Yeah.
And I putted with that thing for about 5 years. And people would always look at it and go, what do you do with that? Like brand cattle? Or what's the deal with that?
Yeah, I had an old Scotty Cameron. I'm trying to forget it.
Oh, Futura or something?
Yeah,
original
Futura.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
again, same thing. It looks like something that you'd be branding cattle with, right? But yeah, if it works, that's fine. I mean, obviously, you know, the commercial's annoying. I've heard, you know, from a performance standpoint, they have to make the shaft really light to allow it to be able to stand up. So I've heard there might be a few breakage issues or whatever. That aside, if anything that's legal allows you to play better and enjoy the game more, have at it.
Love it.
All right. The distance debate, still raging, of course. Opposing camps all over place. You know, they're staked out on social media. If there was a tournament where players had to use equipment from 50 years ago, would you tune in to watch a broadcast or stream?
Absolutely. Why wouldn't you?
That'd be fun.
One PGA Tour event a year. They all have to dress in, you know, all their companies. You got Nike, Puma. They dress them up like Payne Stewart, basically. And, you know, or like maybe it's 60s week. And
sure,
you pick
whatever.
A guy, whatever it is. Just 1 week of the year, play it for the same prize.
Mm-hmm.
Who's not watching that? That's amazing.
I think it'd be great.
Yeah.
I really would. I mean, obviously, I think it'd be difficult to find all the equipment.
Now that's a tour I'd watch. Screw the Premier Golf League Tour. Start
Retro Golf League Tour.
Hickory Stick Golf League Tour.
I think it would be fun. You know, again, I don't know if I'd watch, you know, tens of, you know, events, but I'd watch a couple for sure. I think it'd be entertaining. And again, it's about entertainment. Certainly from a skill level, certainly if they're a talented player, they can adapt. And for me, I'm game for that.
Love it.
All right. Here's one that we'll get often, and you probably got it working in golf retail, as did I. How do you choose which golf ball to play?
I mean, in terms of how do you choose it, you can go through the fitting process, which I recommend if the fitter's ever in. Now, I hate to break it to you. They're only going to fit you into their brand. It's pretty rare to get, you know, an independent guy that's there
it's
with
hard
all
to get
the
agnostic
brands.
With every single golf ball that's out
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. Yeah. How do I choose which golf ball play?
How do you choose?
There's a lot of experience for me at this point where I've actually read reports and played pretty much the top end spinnier version ball of all the brands. Right. And to be honest with you, they're all kind of the same for me. Yeah. They're all very similar. The area I notice the biggest difference mainly is around the greens more than anything. Mm-hmm. I like to spin it a lot around the greens, so I try to find a ball with the most amount of spin. But I'm not that picky. Last year, my bag, you name the brand, you know, whether it was the Pro V1, the Z-Star, you know, the TP5, the Callaway, like, I've played them all at one point, and they're all kind of the same for me. So for me, it's whatever's in the closet right now. And luckily, working in the industry, I get my hands on some golf balls. So I'm not that picky.
Yeah, I think for most people, if we look at it from the consumer side of it, I mean, first of all, they're going to have to decide kind of, you know, what price point that they're
absolutely.
They can
price
play.
Point's
and that plays into it. I mean, obviously, if they're going to go through a lot of golf balls, they're going to want, you know, something that's probably, you know, affordable, whatever the case may be. Some people are on the other side. They don't care. They'll spend as much as they have to get the best golf ball that they can from a performance standpoint. I'm the same as you. You know, for me in choosing a golf ball, it really comes down to starting at the green and working way back, getting the performance, getting the feel that I want around the greens. You know, obviously, if you putt with a certain putter, every putter's got a different feel. And certainly, even if I change putters, I got to, you know, look at how that matches up. We're seeing some manufacturers like Ping this year with their Hepler putters. They're a little firmer in the face. So that plays a part in that. Same thing around the greens, like a certain spin, a little bit characteristic, like certain characteristics of what you want to see from shots, all the way back, going back to the tee. And really, you know what, you can really get your equipment fitted around the ball a little bit, especially off the tee. So definitely around the green is where I use from a selection standpoint, and a little bit different than you. Once I find a model that I like to stick with that because I want consistency in my practice routines, consistency in my yardage, my distance, and what my expectations are when I'm playing it, especially in a tournament round. I don't want all of a sudden a surprise.
Yeah. That being said, when I'm playing around, if, like, for example, when I went down to Arizona, I had a bunch of Z-Stars and I had a bunch of TP5s. So I started the round with the TP5.
Oh, yeah.
I played that ball round. Just not because of the rules, means. It's just that it's
for
feel.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just like to stick with that from a consistency standpoint. But yeah, it's very, very personal. You can look through a lot of things to choose how you go to do that. But I would suggest starting at the green and working your way back. All right, we got a few more here. What is the least number of clubs that you think you could play with and still shoot what would be your average score now with a full bag of clubs? Somebody was really thinking hard on this one.
I think half. Like, I'm thinking you go, and I actually have some proof to this recently, just playing. I mean, it's sim golf, but played a round of sim golf. I was waiting on my new irons to come through. So I had a driver, 3-wood hybrid.
Yep.
My wedges, so a gap wedge, a sand wedge, and a lob wedge.
Okay.
And a 7-iron. I just had one 7-iron that came out of a fitting cart. So I'm missing 4 through pitching wedge, and I have all these, right?
Yep.
And one 7-iron. Shot 1-under.
Nice.
So it's like, I'm thinking, it's sim golf. You're not really putting. We kind of play in a different way, so it doesn't really matter. You don't need to get into the rules and regulations of my sim golf league. But I'm thinking if I actually took it, you know, I practice a lot of knockdown shots, three-quarter shots. You go every other club, driver, take out the 3-wood. You got my hybrid, take out the 4-iron. You can go down. You can figure it out. Pretty sure I'm probably shooting the exact same scores.
Yeah, I'm probably in the same camp. I mean, I think until I was like 14 or 15, I think I had a 7-piece set in my bag probably anyways. Yeah. I didn't really have a full set. you know, obviously it's nice to have options, but the more skill that you get later on, you can certainly create different shots. And yes, it's nice to have, you know, nice even gaps of, you know, 4 degrees between irons. But if you ended up with, 8 degrees and you had to, you know, take a little off and add a little bit more, I think you're right. I'm probably in the same camp as well. I mean, as long as I got a putter in there, a couple of short clubs, something I can hammer off the tee, then I'll figure it out with the rest of it.
I could probably take out an extra wedge, you know, I can.
In some cases, it might be easier because it takes less, you know, less decisions in there. You're forced to hit a certain shot. I mean, it might hurt you here or there for being super precise and hitting a shot super close. But I think in essence, we could all probably have a few less clubs in the bag and be okay.
Love it.
All right, moving along here, we talked about Victor Hovland getting his win, and this relates back to the tweet I ended up putting out. I got this mailbag question, and I turned it into a tweet. How many wins do you think Victor Hovland will have in his PGA Tour career?
We're trying to be Karnak here.
He's 22 years old. He's only had 17 starts on the tour. He's got one win. You know, we know he's going to have at least one.
Yeah, he's got one. let's say five. I mean, you got to look at somebody like Jordan Spieth, right? This is a guy that if you said how many wins is Jordan Spieth going to have in his career like 5 years ago,
yeah,
you would have said 50.
Right. Yeah. True. You're right.
Right.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Like he's lost his game. And Victor Hovland has a couple different things in his golf swing that are far from perfect in the sense of he's got that little hitch at the top that he uses when he wants to hit, you know, a little bit more, hit that big draw. He only uses it, you know, for those certain shots. So I think five's the safe number, somewhere between 5 and 10. Could it be one? Absolutely.
It could be one. That's the only thing we know for certain.
Smiley Kaufman. There's another guy. This guy can't even sniff a cut right now. And I feel bad because Smiley, you know,
nice guy.
He's a likable guy, a nice guy. Any interaction I've had with him, just, you know, small dude.
Yeah.
Right. But you know, it can go. This guy won on the PGA Tour. It can go. You never know. So
there's a lot of one-time winners on the tour.
And there's a lot of guys that won the USAM and never won anything
out on the
PGA Tour. So, you know, somewhere between 1 and 10.
All right.
There's my answer.
Well, I'll give you the percentages of the Twitter poll that I put out. Under 5 came up 15%. 11 to 15 was 27%. 16 plus was 19%. Wow, a lot of people are hot on him. The majority, 39%, but the largest portion of the people voted for 6 to 10 for Victor Hovland. I'm probably near that camp as well. I mean, I guess that's probably the safe way to put it. I mean, who knows? This guy could go nuts and start winning major championships, but really early to even talk about that or start predicting it. But, you know, if somebody gets in 6 to 10 wins on the PGA Tour, that's a pretty, pretty solid career.
Absolutely.
All right, a couple more left here. One of our listeners said, I need a dark horse for my master's pool. Any recommendations? Now, this is pretty exciting, actually, just to be starting to talk about the Masters,
the
right? Yeah.
Seeing the commercials. All right, so I got the betting odds out here. When you're talking dark horses, you're looking for some big numbers guys out there. So a couple names popping out to me right now. Sungjae Im is paying 101-1. That's a great odd. I might sprinkle a few Doneros on there. another name in here, Corey Connors, 151-1.
Ooh.
This guy, yes, Monday qualified, won the Valspar last year, and then went in there and played great. You never know.
He led the PGA Tour in greens and regulation in 2019.
And both of those guys, him and his caddy, they love it there. They can't wait to get back there. So that's one that I absolutely love. Kevin Kisner, if he's playing well, you never know. He's a little short hitter. I don't love that.
Yeah. You know, if the course is playing firm and fast, I could see him being in there, sort of a Zach Johnson type. But, you know, if it's soft, I don't know. I mean, he's from across the river, so he's not from far away.
Nope.
So, you know, that's in his favor. He's certainly seen the facility a few times. But, that's an interesting one.
Got a couple other dark ones here for you. Charlie Hoffman's paying 201-1. This guy always is in the lead after day one on a Masters.
I was going to say, I'd bet on him to lead after day one, but I'm not sure I'd bet on him to win the whole thing.
His odds to probably lead after day one are probably going to be 2-1.
Yeah, probably.
2-1 and then 200-1.
Yeah.
And then another name that this guy, you probably would never notice him unless you got some inside scoops last year before the Open. Robert McIntyre at 200.
The lefty, the Scottish lefty.
201-1. I believe it might be his first
Masters. Yeah, it would be. It would
which
be.
Which is scary.
Yeah.
And then currently we have James Sugru. I don't even know if that's his name.
Who?
Yeah, James Sugrue paying 1,001-1. I wouldn't take him. But just a couple dark horse names in there from my perspective.
I'll throw in one name that I think about at the Masters that I think from a skill standpoint, and you can tell me what the odds are on him. They're probably decent. I wouldn't say they're, you know, exceptional, but Patrick Cantlay has got, I think he's a guy who can perform well there. So, you know, I'd consider him in any pool that I'd be looking at for the Masters.
He's got top 10 odds, 26 to 1.
Oh, wow. Is he? Oh, okay.
Yeah, right. He's up there.
Yeah, I thought he might be a little bit more outside of that.
Louis Oosthuizen still at 51-1. Like, you never know with Louis. Swings smooth. You kind of reacted. One bet here that I...
Louis playing this week, by the way, at the Honda Classic.
There you go. One bet here that I'm saying don't throw money on it, and I'm probably going to come back and eat this one. It's not going to happen. This is his first Masters, I believe, as a professional, but Colin Morikawa at 67 to 1. I don't think that don't waste, save your money this year. I don't know about that one.
I don't know. He's a pretty skilled guy, but yeah, you know what? Rookies don't do well there. It just does not happen. I mean, short of Fuzzy Zeller in 79, it's a hard go. It's a place you really have to learn, especially in the putting greens. I wouldn't shy away from putting him in a top 10, but a win would be a stretch.
Yeah, a top 10 bet would be solid, but a win.
Yeah, that's a tough one. All right, last one here. Thank you, everyone, for the mailbag questions. They were great this week. Getting pretty diverse here. I like this. But last one, how do you think the coronavirus scare will affect golf in the 2020 Olympics? Wow. Okay.
I don't know. Like, that's so. It's very early. I hope zero. I'm just going to leave it at that. I hope it has zero effect on the entirety of it. This is a huge, huge event. A lot of money going towards this, and for that to, I think it could affect players maybe going at some point here. I think a lot of players regret not going to
Brazil.
Brazil there.
And that's the parallel that I think of there. I mean, a lot of people obviously avoided Brazil because of the Zika virus, and, you know, security reasons as well. So there were reasons that they did not participate. I still don't know if, you know, golfers, and some of them have mentioned it, they don't really grow up thinking about being an Olympian as a golfer. So I don't know if they have that emotional attachments. It's obviously getting more, you know, be it Ricky Fowler with his Olympic ring tattoo or whatever. I mean, they see Inbee Park winning, and Justin Rose obviously won. And
yeah, every time they have to hear Justin Rose, Olympic champion, they're probably starting to be like, I wouldn't mind that on my resume.
It's something for life for sure. I guess, you know, it's like anything else. They're going to have to wait and see where things lie as this moves along. And, you know, if the situation maybe cleans up a little bit better and we don't see as high of a risk, I think you'll see a lot more players, you know, if they qualify, I think that you'll see a lot more commit to it than turn it down.
Tiger hurt himself by not playing last week. There's a little bit of news there. I think he doesn't really care about the Olympics. And then one other thing I want to add there before we go to the tip of the week, just went on Colin Morikawa's stats here. This guy's missed one PGA Tour cut ever, and it was his first event in 2016 when he would have been 19 years old.
He was an amateur,
An amateur.
He's not missed one as a pro.
And he even made the next one as an amateur.
Yep.
So this... You know what? If I can find a way to find a missed cut bet, it's going to be him at the Masters. Hit us with the tip of the week because the mailbag's all wrapped up.
All right, tip of the week. Let's talk a little bit about distance leaks with irons. People talk about, you know, losing yardage with woods, but people tend to lose a lot of yardage with their irons basically because they don't deliver the right amount of loft with their irons. They tend to add too much dynamic loft, and what that mean there is that instead of just the static loft that you hear about all the time with golf clubs, dynamic loft is the actual loft that you deliver. And this really happens because people have sequences in their golf swing where they don't really get in a position where their shaft gets leaned forward and they're moving pressure to their forward foot as they take their downswing. Their sequence gets off. As a result of it, instead of delivering the loft of maybe like a 7-iron, you end up delivering the loft of an 8-iron or a 9-iron. You rob yourself of distance. And don't always be chasing just club head speed. It might be the loft that you're delivering that's impacting you and the distance that you're getting out of your irons. So see your golf coach, talk to them, see if there's something that's happening in the sequence of your golf swing that's affecting the dynamic loft, and see what you can do about getting a little bit more yardage out of your clubs by making sure you can deliver that loft properly each time.
When they talk about hitting down on the golf ball, they talk about getting that dynamic loft, de-lofting the golf club.
Yeah, generally that's really what it comes down to, is taking that loft off, making yourself have a situation where basically, you know, you are reducing what the club is, but you're doing it in your golf swing and how you're doing it. And that squeezes the golf ball, gets a little bit more compression out of it, reduces the spin a little bit, and gets a little bit more yardage without having a higher club head speed. Free yardage.
Yeah, you can almost feel it. You can set up statically where you're just standing there and just feeling that shaft lean with your weight on the front leg. I try to do that for sure. So that's a great tip for this week. Big week. Honda Classic week. The bear trap. Scotty's favorite saying.
You know what? I'll probably watch the Oman Open with Aaron Cockerell out of Europe, probably more than I'll watch Honda. But yeah, or Stephen Ames, who's got a top 10 streak going on the PGA Tour Champions. I'm probably more interested in that.
Fair enough. Well, we're only a couple weeks away from the Players. I can guarantee you you will be interested in that.
Definitely.
So why don't we wrap it up there? Thank you, Casey Ward, for coming on the program this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next week. Like today, my boat's lost in the ocean.